Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Tony winner Mary Louise Wilson, forever dubbed the best thing in it in review after review, has written a memoir about her life in the theater, movies, and television. My First 100 Years in Show Business tells Wilson's story through the eight-year journey of turning a memoir of Vogue editor Diana Vreeland into the career peak triumph, Full Gallop, the show that made Wilson a star in her 60s. Mary Louise Wilson's numerous award-winning roles include Vera Joseph in 4,000 Miles at Lincoln Center, Big Edie in Grey Gardens, Fräulein Schneider in Cabaret, Queen Elizabeth in The Beard of Avon, and Diana Vreeland in Full Gallop. Her writing has appeared in The New Yorker and The New York Times. She has taught acting at Tulane University, and she is fresh from finishing a run on stage in the hit revival of On the 20th Century. Before a live audience in Rhinecliff, New York, we welcome Mary Louise Wilson to this week's book show. As an actress, do you live for that?
Oh, yes.
Is that what got you in the business in the first place?
You mean response? Yeah, sure. Laughs. Laughs and then applause.
Well, you make the distinction in the book. Laughs, very important to you.
Oh, yeah.
Is it easier to act than it is to be funny?
Oh, yeah. I think comedy is harder to do than tragedy.
What is so difficult about it?
Getting laughs.
So how much of it is the material? How much is on you as the actor? So if you look at something on the page mm-hmm. and you feel that it's funny,
yes.
you know where you can milk it.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's up to the audience to respond. If they do, that's great. And if they don't?
Sometimes they don't. Yeah.
And can you figure that out?
Do yeah, try. We actors all do try. Well, I didn't get that laugh. What's wrong? I didn't get that laugh. Put the emphasis on the thee. Say the boy instead of the boy. That may do it. There are different kinds of laughs, too. Some are better than others. Some are cheap, you know.
So if you say you make a vulgar joke, okay, then you'll get a cheap laugh, right?
Yeah.
But if you really work on it, and mm-hmm. it's something that you work toward, and you get that laugh, if it's a deep, sustained laugh, that must be the best feeling in the world.
It is great, and it only comes from being truthful, though, basically. If you can be truthful and get a laugh, that's a good laugh.
Okay, so what does that mean, be truthful?
Well, there are ways to make an audience laugh by big pauses and certain things you can do that are just mechanical. That's what I call cheap. If you have a good script that you can really become the character and get laughs that way, then that's really gold.
So is someone like Lucille Ball, who is so known for physical comedy,
yeah,
but obviously was a comedian.
Yeah, but it always came from a truthful place in her. What the character would actually do. You know, it was always within character.
You grew up in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
You say that you always knew that you were going to go to New York.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
From a very young age.
Mm-hmm. I came out of the womb packed and ready.
What was there about you and about that place that you felt would be a fit?
I didn't fit in school, and I just sort of sensed that misfits were okay in New York. And I have to say, I think I said this in the book, but Life magazine was a big, big thing in those days. Every family read Life.
Mm-hmm.
And Life had this picture thing they did, Life Goes To. And they were always going to New York and showing a fashion model's day, you know, starting at 6 a.m. with a cup of coffee, hailing the cab. I just loved all that. And then they'd have lovers at Coney Island, you know. I just ate all that up.
So when you first got there,
mm-hmm.
how long was it before you felt like you had found your place?
Oh, a while. I didn't have any confidence about being in the theater. So I worked dumb jobs. I think when I first came, I thought some guy's going to marry me and save me. You know, that was the idea.
That didn't happen.
It didn't work out, no.
No. And you worked a lot of, you did a lot of reviews.
Yeah, that's once, yeah, once I got on that bandwagon, that was great.
And so these were shows that were happening in the Village. They were sort of exploding at this period of time. And you talk about people like Joan Rivers and others.
Well, everybody had an act. Yeah, everybody was trying out their acts. But I was in a cabaret review that was very hot at that time called the Julius Monk Reviews. And it was like the hot ticket in town. You know, everybody in the audience was a celebrity. You know, it was great to get into that. And then at the same time, Second City started to happen in the Village, which was a completely different thing from what we were doing in Julius Monk's. So it was all happening. That was in the early 60s.
You talk a lot in the book about being a character actor as opposed to being a star.
Mm-hmm.
Did you start out wanting to be a star?
No. I mean, the people I loved and that I saw in the movies, well, I mentioned Eve Arden, who she was like the uber featured actress, character actress, you know, with the big purse, sitting on the edge of the sofa, making wise cracks out of the side of her mouth, you know. That's what I wanted.
How easy were those roles for you to find?
Well, at first it was just comedy, you know, comic sketches, comedy, musical comedy. I really wanted something more, but that took a long time, you know. I was in musicals for a few years before I could get into plays.
You write in the book that the music part of it, the singing, was almost, well, not something that you particularly enjoyed.
No, I didn't want to, but you had to sing. If you wanted to be funny, you had to sing and dance. I couldn't dance, and no one could make me dance.
So you just finished with On the 20th Century, a six-month run on Broadway, and it's a musical.
Where, not to brag, but I had to work. The role was originally done by Imogene Coca, who is a soprano, and I had to really work on my voice because I'm more or less a basso. And I worked a lot, and I actually got up there. I got a huge range up. I couldn't believe it. You know, so I really have quite a range now. Would you like to hear me?
I would love to hear you.
Some other time.
Okay. I can't afford to hear your range, I guess. when you do something like that, I would think that 8 shows a week, 6 days a week, would just kill you.
It is a killer. Yeah, it's too bad. Because by the end, you know, halfway through the week, you can't really, you're just glad you can breathe and get the lines out. You know, there's nothing left over to do, you know, do something more. It's a vicious, they should have understudies do the matinees, but you know, Broadway's a money operation. That's what it's all about.
Did you always feel that way about the 8 shows a week or doing a show for a while?
I'll ask any actor and they'll tell you it's just a killer. You have Monday off and then Tuesday, that's lovely. And then you're hit in the face with a wet mackerel, which is the Wednesday matinee, and then the Wednesday evening thing. So you pull your socks up, you do Thursday, that's great, Friday, that's great, and then Saturday, another mackerel, two show day, and then Sunday matinee. It's just a little, maybe one show too many. And there are actors in the union trying to get a smaller schedule, but it'll never happen. I mean, when Bette Midler did her show, she didn't have to do that. It was great, you know. She only had to do like 5 shows a week, made millions.
And that was by her schedule of saying, this is what I can do.
Yeah, sometimes I think the only way to be is a star. You can call the shots, you know.
Have you ever felt like a star?
I did in my own show.
Full Gala.
Though I had a friend say, you're acting like a featured player in your own show, you know, because that was my friend Mark Hampton who wrote it with me. Sometimes I hold back. But I felt like a star then. It was lovely.
Much of this book is
getting the show on. Yeah.
Is looking at putting Full Gallop up. Mm-hmm. What was it about that you were so passionate about and that you ultimately learned from and wanted to write about?
You mean what brought me to want to write about her?
Mm.
Well, she was glamorous and funny. And that's what I wanted. I never quite achieved it, but I really wanted to be glamorous and funny at the same time. She was funny, knowingly funny. She was also unknowingly funny, her facial expressions and so on. She was extremely odd looking. She looked like a camel. She was a very attractive person, really.
When did you first become aware of her and the idea of wanting to explore that life?
Well, I was first aware of her when I came to New York in the 50s because she ruled everything. I didn't know her name or anything, but there was somebody telling me where my skirt should be from year to year, and the hem went down and came up to, you know, just by quarter of an inch. But I also, when I was a kid, my mother had these Southern women over for bridge, and a lot of them were glamorous and funny, and I think that's when I was first hit with the bug, you know, the Vreeland bug.
Is there an aspect of her life that you thought, okay, there is an arc here, there's a show, there's a story I can tell about this woman?
Well, yeah, she was at the top of her game. She was fired from Vogue magazine as the editor-in-chief. And I've always been fascinated by what do people do when they've been in power and then they're out? Nixon, I think they've done some shows about that, you know, what was he doing? And also, I remember George Baker. When Clinton came in, there was a little article about how Baker had asked Clinton if he could stay on as Secretary of State. And I thought, God, how desperate, you know.
Yeah.
So when she was fired, that was really interesting. So that's what we wrote the show about, what she did after she was fired.
Mary Louise Wilson is our guest on this week's book show. The new book is My First 100 Years in Show Business. It is published by Overlook. When you started in New York, was Broadway is what I ultimately want to get to.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
So the Broadway debut was what?
It was a show called Hot Spot with Judy Holliday. It was a huge, famous bomb.
How long did it run?
3 weeks.
Did you know?
Oh, yeah. So I write about this. I mean, the first day of rehearsals, we were told, we have no second act, and everybody applauded, and I thought, what? But Judy Holliday was incredible, wonderful, terrific performer.
Does it make sense when you have a great cast or when you have a great talent of when it doesn't work?
Yeah, stars, you know, in those days there was a star and then there was the chorus and there was two featured players. It was very structured. And then you had the writing team and the music team, and very often they were in different courts, you know, and then there's a star in the middle. I don't think it's as much like that anymore. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know that many Broadway shows, but it was difficult. It was hard, you know, because it was a vehicle for her, so it didn't have anything else to hold her up.
Tell me about the experience being in Gypsy.
Gypsy is just a fabulous show from every aspect in terms of the script, the music, the characters, and much of it is because of Jerome Robbins, because he was so relentless about cutting out any extra fluff. So I got to play Tessie Tura, the balletic stripper, which is a fabulous part, and understudy Angela Lansbury at the same time. So that was a great time. It was great.
Working with someone like that, working for somebody like Angela, with Angela Lansbury, is that an unforgettable experience?
Well, I don't know if unforgettable is the word. She was great. She was not like going out with you for drinks afterwards. You know, she was working really hard. It was very a businesslike thing. Though after that, I've since run into her and met her, and she's great, lovely.
You write in the book, I've been on the road 3 times. One general rule is the farther away the cast gets from home, the more they start sleeping around. You fall into bed with people you wouldn't ordinarily throw sticks at.
It's a fact.
It seems, as an actor, though, that just that idea of being on the road would be really monotonous.
It's hard. Yeah, anything. It's hard, yeah. Some people love it. If you're a gambler, you know, you play poker, it's great. And I once had a guy say to me, you know what I love about it, Mary Louise? The baths. He was visiting the baths in all the different towns. You get it.
You write about going to Los Angeles and your foray into television.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on paper, this seems great because you're going in with Norman Lear, who at the time, and even now, I mean, is still considered
the master. Yeah.
Absolute incredible master. Yeah. So he's doing One Day at a Time. And the thing, when he was on our show, told us that the one thing he was looking for in the people that he cast were stage actors, because they were perfect, because he didn't want to do a traditional situation comedy. He wanted to do basically a play. So he sees you and invites, does he see you in Gypsy?
Yeah.
And invites you to
be on the show.
Be in the show. Mm-hmm. And you go out there. I just want to read this one part. You're in Royal Family.
Mm-hmm.
I gave my notice at Royal Family, and as soon as I was out, I sat down to watch an episode of One Day at a Time. Actually, Denny and I sat down, smoked a joint, and watched.
That's a friend, Denny Dillon, and I, yeah.
Our jaws dropped, slowly. Even on pot, there was not a laugh in a carload. The series was about a single mother raising two daughters. It was one of the first shows on the subject and a big hit. Lear's series was distinctive for mixing moral issues in with the comedy, issues like sexism, racism, pregnancy, out of wedlock, and rape. Sometimes the fit was uncomfortable. The audience would be howling at Archie Bunker when suddenly they heard Edith warbling and she'd almost been raped. The audience, pulled up by the short hairs, muttered a confused, chastised, "Oh."
Oh.
So you go into this family, really, because it's Bonnie Franklin, Valerie Bertinelli, Mackenzie Phillips, and Pat Harrington.
Pat Harrington,
And it's awful.
Oh. Yeah.
What didn't you like?
Bonnie Franklin. I don't mean to speak ill of the dead, but it's terrible that she died. But first of all, even without Bonnie, the whole idea of four-camera TV, I was not prepared for, where you go out in front of the audience before you go on in your bathrobes, and then it was so opposite to stage work, you know, where you hide backstage until you come out as the character, you know. And then you go on, and the cameraman says, 2, 3, 4, go! Hello, girls. That's your first line, you know. And then all the air goes out as you wait for the camera 4 to go on Valerie Bertinelli, who says, "Hi, Ginny." You know, it's like, I just couldn't get with it. There was no energy in the actual scene because you waited for these cameras. I think it's much more sophisticated now. I couldn't get used to it. I was used to really, and also they would keep me after to react. I said, react to what? They wanted reaction shots. I didn't realize that the whole show was about reactions, you know. Bonnie's reactions lasted for hours, you know. And I would say my line very quickly, and then the camera was off me and on someone else, you know. So I didn't adjust well to it. I just couldn't find a character to play. I had nothing to hide behind.
Was there something that, because obviously there's money in television, it would have been nice to find that role, that place. So the lure of it must have been fairly strong.
Yeah, I'm not the usual. I just didn't want to go to California. I didn't want to go. I didn't get that doing TV would help me get better parts on Broadway. I didn't get that, you know. Or I got it too late.
The other thing that surprises me is that, well, when you won the Tony Award, it changed your life how?
Oh, well, I didn't work for a year.
How does that happen?
You win a Tony and then you forget it. No one calls. I think they're afraid you raised your price or something. I don't know. It's standard. I know a lot of people said it. One Harriet Harris said, "I won the wrong Tony." It takes a while to get over it. Yeah.
In your acceptance speech, you just howl. You just say, "I'm having the best time."
This is great. Because Kate McLaughlin's Beagle used to howl happy birthday, and I couldn't think of what to say. So I just howled.
When did you start to then find your place?
That's when I was in this Scottish play at the Public, and the director said, "I'm giving your chestnut speech to the younger, prettier witch." And I thought, the hell with this, you know. Couldn't get any worse, so... I, I was aware of Reeland, you know, I was very aware of her then because she was dying and they were talking about her jewelry and stuff being sold at Sotheby's. I guess she was broke. So Mark and I started being fascinated by her. Every actor should have a show that they're working on. I never had such a great experience as having my own thing and writing it. It was just absorbed me. You know, I loved it.
And there's actors that take that with them forever.
Yeah.
Would you want that? Or
No, I didn't. It was so great in New York City, I didn't want to go to Cincinnati. Well, they wouldn't know what the hell I was talking about, you know.
Is there anything that you are still dying to do, that that you want to achieve, that you said, this would be fun?
Well, I did want to do a clown part, and I finally got it with Letitia Primrose in 20th Century. I really wanted to play a nut, a clown, and believe it or not, I never got those parts. I was always mad that someone else got them. The only thing I think I would like to do, if I could, is restoration comedy, but it's very seldom done. It's just not done that much, I think, because there's so many actors are required. Maybe I'm wrong, but...
I asked that question to Estelle Parsons about 2 weeks ago, and I said, is there anything that you still want to do? And she said, oh, my God, no. I'm good. Thank you.
Yeah,
I love working, but I'm good.
I feel pretty much that way. I've certainly had a lot. I've had everything you could ask for.
I want you to read a section from the book, and this is, you're writing about your film work.
Yeah, but some of my film work, my great record of film work. Please don't get excited. In 82, I was hired to be in Zelig, Woody Allen's film. I didn't get the script. I was going to play his evil sister. I didn't get a script. Allen was famous for not letting anybody see his scripts, but then I didn't have any lines. Before filming began, I was called in for a costume check. The genius costumer Santo Lacosta was doing the costumes. I may not have had lines, but I had an extensive wardrobe of beautiful clothes. This test day, I was put into an outfit and taken up some stairs to a makeup room for Alan's approval. Alan was sitting in the makeup chair watching a ball game on television. When he turned to check out my outfit, half of his face was black with big lips and bushy black brows. I went away, put on another costume, and came back. This time he was putty-faced with Asian eyes. I couldn't control myself. I burst out laughing. I learned later that Zelig was about a man who turned into whomever he was with. If he was introduced to an African-American, he turned into an African-American. If he was with an Asian, etc. On the first day of shooting, Alan turned to me and said, "Don't act." I shot back, "Don't worry." And that was about the extent of our conversation. Over the next couple of months, I climbed in and out of several Hispano Suiza cars with him without exchanging a word. Now and then, an inadvertent giggle escaped me. Nerves. There were a lot of crowd scenes in Zelig. One day, the streets of Bensonhurst were teeming with Hasidim in black hats, and the next day, they were filled with Nazi soldiers. It was like being inside a Woody Allen dream. One location was the enormous lobby of an old movie theater in some outer borough. I was costumed and told to wait. Hours went by. I fell asleep on somebody's coat in a van. Around 3 a.m., I was shaken awake and escorted into the theater. The lobby was jammed with 200 extras in evening wear, and every single one of them was holding a lit cigarette. When I wasn't in the shot, there was no designated place to hang out other than the street. One day, the crowd was milling around in drab 30s costumes when the lunch break was called, and a guy on a dolly high above us with a bullhorn started yelling, "Move back against the wall! Move back against the wall!" He was trying to get the principals in line before the extras, but it felt a bit too reminiscent of another time. I was also in a drab 30s getup, and when the bullhorn tried to herd me back with the crowd, I barked, "I am not an extra!" It sounded in my ears like, "I am not a Jew." Fortunately, I knew the makeup lady, Fern, from another job. Fern and Romaine, the hair lady, rescued me. Fern and Romaine were known as the Lettuce Sisters. They let me hang out in their trailer and filled me in on the script. Another time, we were in a holding area in a school basement in some suburb when I looked across the room and saw Hitler sitting there. Suddenly, he saw me and waving excitedly shouted, "Deluise, hi!"
Mary Louise Wilson's new memoir is My First 100 Years in Show Business. It's published by Overlook Press. Mary Louise Wilson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe.
What a great pleasure. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. This special edition was recorded at the Morton Memorial Library in Rhinecliff, New York, in partnership with Oblong Books and Music and Rhinebeck and Millerton. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.